as a smokescreen to achieve the foreign policy objectives of the Israeli regime in the UK. The campaign against anti-Semitism was founded in London to divert attention from Israel's massacre of over 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza. The first action was to organise a demonstration against and boycott of the Tricycle Theatre in Kilburn, which wanted to return a small donation from the Israeli embassy for a film festival, the shortfall being made up by the theatre itself. The CAA falsely claimed the theatre had banned the event. The CAA has been funded by Natan, an organisation chaired by Tony Felsen, a strong supporter and donor to the Friends of the Israel Defence Forces. It is also funded by the Jewish National Fund UK, an organisation described by historian Ilan Pape as a colonialist agency of ethnic cleansing which builds settlements in occupied Palestine. Accounts for the JNF UK show that it provides financial backing to recruitment drives for the Israeli Defence Forces and also to Ian Pratt, a group which enlists North Americans into the Army of Occupation. The JNF is currently being investigated by the Charity Commission after its head, Samuel Hayek, made Islamophobic comments using far-right talking points. The JNF UK honorary patrons include the Prime Minister and President of the Israeli regime, as well as Tony Blair and previously former British Prime Minister David Cameron. The chief executive of the campaign against anti-Semitism is Gideon Falter, who simultaneously serves as the vice chair of the JNF UK. CAA also obtained a very unusual dispensation from Companies House and the Charity Commission to keep its directors secret, even after a challenge under Freedom of Information legislation. We can reveal that one of these, listed as unnamed on the CAA website, is actually Daniel Allington, a lecturer for King's College London. Allington's work is funded by the Alfred Landecker Foundation, run by a pro-Israel lobbyist, Andreas Eberhardt. Allington also does work for the CAA as an academic, without any public disclosure that he is a director, a clear conflict of interest. The CAA website used to tout its honorary patrons, which included Colonel Richard Kemp, a close friend of Benjamin Netanyahu, who was embedded with the Israeli military in Gaza as it sniped Palestinians on the Great March of Return in 2018. Also, there was Mark Lewis of UK Lawyers for Israel, a lawfare lobby group which works closely with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Despite these honorary patrons proudly associating with CAA, it suddenly made the page on its website unavailable in 2019. Are these individuals no longer patrons? Why the secrecy? The CAA targets pro-Palestine actors with false accusations of anti-Semitism. Before he joined CAA, its director, Gideon Falter, was found to have given a false account of an incident in which a diplomat had denounced Israel. Its reports and research are widely criticized by Jewish groups as flawed and irresponsible. The CAA played a key role in smearing the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn. It submitted a huge dossier to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, including many false and exaggerated accusations of anti-Semitism. The CAA is also pushing the war on academia to silence criticism of Zionism. When racism comes in the guise of anti-racism, the question is, how can we resist?
To discuss the campaign against anti-Semitism and the forces behind it, we're joined today by a special guest, Shahad Abu Salama, who is a Palestinian writer, activist and artist who has twice been made a refugee by the Zionist Project. She is an associate lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University, and she has recently completed a PhD on the historical representation of Palestinian refugees in documentary cinema. As Shahad has publicly stated, she was defamed and harassed by Zionist publications and was then suspended from her job. However, after a short but intense campaign, she was reinstated to her position on an enhanced contract. Shahad, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David, and solidarity with you.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, you must be very relieved at this turn of events. It's been fantastic that you've been reinstated. How do you feel?
Of course, it's a win for Palestine. I see it. And we managed with the collective action and the people who spoke up in support of me to turn the tide and expose the malicious accusations, that were trying to deflect from Israeli crimes that I witnessed and lived through. So it is a great welcome step from the university. However, the bullying and the trolls and the Zionist media defamation has been nonstop.
Sure. You've brought with you a very interesting book. I think maybe you would like to tell us a bit about how this book relates to some of your back history and how that relates then to the attacks that there have been on you.
Yeah, so I'm carrying Felicia Langer's book with my own eyes. Felicia Langer is an Israeli-German lawyer who have defended Palestinian political prisoners since 1967. And she became the lawyer of my father in 1972, when she met him as a 19-year-old, and she recorded his story. My father, this wasn't the first time that he was in prison. He was first in prison when he was 14 or 15 years old. And of course, needless to say that this is a stark violation of international law. Children should be protected, they should be at school, they should be safe in their homes and not subject to such persecution. So the second time that he was arrested, when he was 19 and was defended by Felicia Langer, he pled not guilty. And he didn't do anything except being Palestinian, angry at the realities of the occupation that meant they could have their houses raided in the middle of the night. He speaks here about... wait a minute, I want to read this quote as came from my dad. "I saw children getting killed in the streets of the camp," he says. "Shot by the frontier police. They come to the refugee camp with clubs, beat everybody, go into the houses without knocking on the door. There are women inside. They mix flour into the oil during the searches, yes, maliciously, without a reason." And then he says further about the torture that he received in the investigation that lasted nearly 3 months. And he lost, as a result of that torture, he lost his sense of hearing, 19 years old. And he said that this even included psychological torture. He said, "Then they threatened me, unless I talked, I would be punished to Amman, where I would be killed." And there are a lot more stories here, but this woman has been an example that I grew up with, you know? She is one of the most fearless anti-Zionist voices that spoke and acted on the side of the Palestinians, because she saw the injustice and she renounced her citizenship in 1991, yeah, the year I was born, and went to Germany, a luxury that she can do, mm-hmm, of course. She left Germany believing that she could not serve justice to the Palestinians under that Israeli apartheid.
And now we come back to today, where organizations like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, yeah, have targeted you. Many others have targeted you. You referred to trolls and media. Can, yeah, you tell us a little bit about the kind of effects of that targeting and what kind of groups there are arrayed against you?
So it started actually with Jewish News. I learned from the Zionist press, Jewish News in particular, that my university was investigating me. And that was Christmas Eve. And sadly, the same day, I was mourning the loss of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And I was mourning, And at the same time, I received this disturbing article that says my university is investigating me, and as a staff member and a PhD student at the university, I should be the first to be approached, not the Zionist media. And I wasn't told. I was left in the dark all this time, preparing for my new position as an associate lecturer teaching post-colonial media culture. And I went to the first lecture that was on 17th of January. And I knew that there was, you know, by then there were the Jewish news article and then the campaign against anti-Semitism that skipped over my right to reply completely and just defamed me without paying any consideration to my lived experience or my response to their previous defamations that they raised against me. Because this is not the first time that I'm being silenced and demonized. And of course, for the Palestinians, like, we see this as a part of a consistent pattern that predicates on our demonization and the manipulation of our own reality and histories for the justification and the legitimacy of the Israeli state. Yeah.
So we've got another report now, which tells us a little bit more about the background to your case. And we'll come back to talk about more about your experiences after that.
Thank you so much.
A victory for Palestine. Those were the words of Palestinian academic Shahad Abu Salam after news broke that her British university dropped an investigation against her. Shahad Abu Salama, an activist from Gaza, was appointed as an associate lecturer at Sheffield's Hallam University last month, but was suspended from teaching amidst the investigation. She was accused of sharing anti-Semitic views over her past criticism of Israel and the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
The Palestinians have a right to resist their occupier by any means necessary. And this is a right that is entrenched in international law. And no one can take that right from us.
Despite the university's U-turn, an apology remains elusive, despite the immense distress caused.
After a lifelong of struggle, I just want to say that I'm standing here with all of these people. They're all from all sorts of backgrounds, and they're all standing proudly, co-resisting Israeli apartheid with me, and demanding that freedom, justice, and equality is served to the Palestinians. This is long overdue.
University authorities have not yet specified the group or individuals who filed the complaints which led to the suspension. However, Abu Salama is a high-profile rights campaigner and a vocal critic of the definition of Zionism, leading many to suspect pro-Israel groups are trying to whip up a, quote, witch hunt against her. Abu Salama was supported by her professional body, the Universities and Colleges Union, which passed an emergency motion in her defense. They said her public campaigning against Israel falls entirely within the boundaries of acceptable political commentary. This isn't the first survival battle Abu Salama has faced. She and her family are refugees, ethnically cleansed from their home in what is now Israel by Zionist militias in 1948. Like all other Palestinian refugees, they are barred by Israel from returning to their original homes. Amina Taylor for Palestine Declassified.
Shahad, what did you make of that? Can you bring us up to date with your case?
Thank you for the report. It's a great report and definitely put things in context. At the minute, we're still carrying on, you know, like the anger that the victory has created is still posing pressure on me, but also on my university. My father, who's a freedom fighter, is being accused of being a convicted terrorist, and I'm basically a daughter of a convicted terrorist. And of course, that is an ideological condemnation of a legitimate right to resist. And this is the right that is guaranteed by international law. the right of the occupied people to resist their occupier until liberation. And this is what we're doing. We're trying to reclaim our humanity.
And yet, on campus, there are organizations who are fighting for the rights of the occupier.
Exactly.
The UK Lawyers for Israel, for example, they have people on campus at Sheffield. The Union of Jewish Students there, they have a JSOC on campus there, headed by the daughter of a prominent pro-Israel sociologist. Can you tell us about how that manifests itself, the active involvement, not just of off-campus groups, but on-campus groups?
I mean, it is horrendous, really. When I saw the latest report by the Jewish Chronicle that uses Jewish in order to conflate between Zionism and Judaism and quell criticisms of Israel. They have made their whole story around me being a terrorist and a daughter of a terrorist, and then how that makes Jews unsafe, based on one single statement from the president of JSOC at the University of Sheffield. So imagine the such generic false statement made against a whole university just because they did the right thing. Because they did the right thing. I was being silenced, and the university knows that they were unfair to me. And what happened in terms of suspension and the university communicating with the Zionist press and feeding into their lies before even approaching me, that was very harmful. That added fuel to fire. And we cannot accept such scaremongering statement that contribute to racial hatred and ethno-religious divisions on campus. We cannot accept that.
So what we find, I think, in your case and in many other cases, in my own case at Bristol, in cases in Warwick and in Glasgow, is the university effectively collaborating with the bullies and the people who are trying to intimidate pro-Palestine activists. Can you say, just in closing, what you think is the way forward for resisting this kind of bullying?
A lot should be done. And I think the production of knowledge in itself is resistance. And this counter-narrative that comes out with programs like this, Palestine Declassified, that that comes with stories such as mine, the Palestinian story, that many Palestinians would be able to identify with. We have to resist in whatever we can, with whatever tool we have, because every morning we know Palestinians are waking up to more crimes of ethnic cleansing, of dispossession. The siege is suffocating a whole population in Gaza that is mass incarcerated in the world's largest open-air prison while frequently bombarded. Let's not forget, just last May, 2,070 people were killed. F-16 bombs fell 10 meters away from my house while my family were inside. Can you believe the terror that they lived? And these are serious struggles. These are serious grievances that Israel cannot defend. And that's why they're using the card, abusing the card of anti-Semitism. That is a real issue. And bypassing it and twisting it in order to avoid accountability. And we have to be the pressure that brings Israeli apartheid to justice. We have to be the change. And we are.
But that change also needs to push back against those other forces that are involved, the media you've talked about. Can you tell us about the kind of impact that the media and then the trolls have on ordinary activists on the ground and who are doing work in this area?
I mean, of course, it has a chilling effect, and the IHRA definition has been widely criticized by even the person who drafted it. And he said that it wasn't fit for purpose, and it was only going to feed into racial hatred and division, and probably even anti-Semitism. And this is serious. And there were people who have been saying over and over again that Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, and they are the ones who keep on emphasizing that they are speaking in the name of the world Jewry, when they are far from that. There are more and more Jews around the world that are speaking up against it and saying, no, this is not in my name. No religion would endorse crimes such as this that are being committed in Palestine in daylight, every day. And we are speaking up against it, and we're not going to let their fear-mongering get under our skin. We have a just cause, and we have to resist these forces wherever they are until they are isolated, the same way South African apartheid was isolated, and the people who were part of it were isolated.
So we have to talk about the end of Zionism as an ideology, an ideology which is by its nature racist. And, and one of the first steps surely has to be resisting the IHRA definition, but that's only the first step, surely.
I mean, like the IHRA, before there was the prevent strategy that also affected us seriously, and before that there were lots of unspoken rules that immediately took the side of the oppressor against the oppressed. I mean, like, as a Palestinian, you see that all the time. I've lived through, you know, 22 days of constant bombing against the Gaza Strip, 2008, 2009. I was only 17, attending mid-school exams and studying on candlelight of the scarcity of electricity, and in constant fear over my life and my loved ones' lives. And these, under those times, I've noticed how international media is part of the problem.
Yeah,
we were feeling isolated, being killed in our masses, and displaced over again. My father's school that was turned into a makeshift shelter was bombed with white phosphorus, internationally banned weapons. All these crimes have to be addressed, and they have to be brought...
Yes. Thank you very much. Sorry, that's all we've got time for. Shad, thank you very much for your inspiring words.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, everyone, and we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. I've been David Miller. Bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Waxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading Censoring Palestine. Swarms of Israeli regime bots are crippling pro-Palestinian Twitter accounts. Here's more. On April 29th, Ines Abdulrazak woke up to 80 new Twitter followers. These accounts were following the exact same people that were tweeting about Palestine, but from France or Francophone accounts that work on Palestine, Razak said for her new followers. The advocacy director of Rabbit, the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy's digital platform, became wary of the issue after Abir Khateb, a grants manager at Open Society Foundations, reported mass followings as well. Razak told Min Press News that she began individually reporting each account as fake, but kept her own account open, lest she let the alleged bots win. But after a few days, Razak made her profile private. At the peak of the mass following, Razak had accumulated 400 fake followers. From the end of April through the first few weeks of May, more than 40 pro-Palestine Twitter accounts reported mass followings. Digital rights experts say acquiring huge amounts of fake followers triggers Twitter's algorithm and can lead to the tech giant suspending an account, effectively censoring users by forcing them to make their accounts private. These accounts included those belonging to human rights, activist organizations, Adala, Combatants for Peace, Breaking the Silence, and Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights. They also included news publications and journalists like the Palestine Chronicle, Ali Abu Nima and Hend Al-Iryani, and politicians such as Hossam Zumlot, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK. Twitter did not respond to Min Press inquiries on the source of suspicious accounts. Dr. Mark Owen Jones, an assistant professor at Hamad Ben Khalifa University, conducted an analysis that found more than 1,150 fake accounts. Twitter deleted approximately 1,090 of these accounts, according to Jones. His analysis determined that the average account creation time was one of the three per minute, suggesting these accounts were created using an automated process. The profiles were in various languages, including French, Spanish, English, and German, but usually had Arabic bias. They often had strange names like Nobel Betty Thomas and zero followers. They had clearly made up names. Sarah Lee Whitson, who also experienced a large influx of new followers, told Min Press. The vast majority of them had Israeli names and Israeli addresses. Some of them had made up Arab names, which were mangled. It's clear that they are using stolen images of people. In response to the bulk following, software developer Daniel Isterman created a free script to automatically report and block hundreds of these bots for users. Isterman said the spamming problem has a censorship effect by forcing users to make their accounts private. This means they won't be able to distribute their messages widely as they would normally, Isterman told Min Press News. Another area of particular concern is how a flood of fake followers may cause Twitter to shut down an account. When you see such a dramatic increase in followers, it's usually somebody manipulating the system for commercial gain, Isterman said, adding so that could trigger Twitter to automatically flag that as suspicious activity and suspend the activist account.
Using Twitter to target human rights defenders and journalists isn't unusual. In 2017, journalist Lona Craig and others who report on Yemen were spammed with thousands of fake followers. Many speculated the culprits were state entities belonging to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The reason behind this particular mass following campaign remains unknown. Jones hypothesized it's acting as a form of social media suppression, writing on Twitter. Some suggest it's a means to degrade the algorithmic quality of a Twitter account so that it possibly gets suspended. Some suggest it's others trying to boost popularity of an account. When it's unsolicited, as in this case, I tend to think it's more of a targeting operation. I'm naturally cynical, but most people who get a sudden influx of fake followers feel unnerved and uncomfortable. If that fact is widely known, it functions as a tool of surveillance and potentially intimidation, that is, you are being watched. It also makes many people mute their accounts for a bit, which has a censorship effect. Razek Whitson and others told Mint Press News that the flood of fake followers appears to be diminishing for them. However, a new operation has emerged. In the past week, Jones found around 2,800 fake accounts following pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist accounts who have recently been tweeting on the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh by the Zionist regime. This network is likely the same as one found at the end of April, although now it is active, Jones wrote on Twitter. The accounts have been 0 to 20 followers, with the majority of bias written in English and simply stating the account location, which is the occupied territories. Most accounts don't have a banner picture, and the profile pictures have reportedly been swiped from real people. According to Jones, the accounts have begun liking and retweeting posts without any real partisan regularity. They like both pro- and anti-Palestinian subject matter and follow both pro-Zionist and pro-Palestinian accounts, but appear to target the pro-Palestinian side more. Accounts targeted include the Jerusalem Post, activist organization Jewish Voice for Peace, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, Israeli journalist Ilan Papp, and former Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. Again, the reason for the bulk followers remains unclear. Those who get followed understandably find it intimidating, as if a form of surveillance, to a technique to try and degrade the quality of an account with low-quality follows, Jones wrote on Twitter. The fact remains these are clearly fake accounts and ruin the experience of Twitter. Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. During the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza and upticks in Israeli regime attacks at Al-Aqsa compound and in Sheikh Jarrah in May 2021, Palestinian activists reported social media companies were removing their content on the Israeli regime violence and ethnic cleansing for violating community guidelines. The social media censorship didn't stop when tensions died down over the summer, though. Last month, social media users in Jordan said their posts related to Israeli regime violence at Al-Aqsa were taken down and their accounts blocked. Additionally, accounts belonging to Palestinian news publications covering the violence in East Al-Quds and at Al-Aqsa were deactivated by Facebook. In their recent monthly report on social media violations, Palestinian NGO Sada Social stated the deletion of Palestinian content is in line with and in response to Israeli requests to tighten the screws on Palestinians and their media. Razek suggested the swarm of fake followers on Twitter may be an extension of Instagram's shadow banning. While the identities behind the fake followers haven't been revealed, many have pointed to the fabricated regime of Israel. The regime of Israel targeting of Palestinian digital content is well documented. According to Hamla, the Arab Center for the Advancement of Social Media, the Israeli regime Ministry of Justice Cyber Unit sends content removal requests aimed at Palestinian content to social media companies such as Facebook, Google, and YouTube. The Justice Ministry has boasted these corporations comply with 95% of the request, and the Zionist regime organizations and NGOs also encourage their citizens to flag Palestinian content for removal. Tech billionaire Elon Musk's pending purchase of Twitter came with a promise of securing free speech on the digital platform. Free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, and Twitter is the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, the self-declared free speech advocate said in a statement about his Twitter deal. While digital rights experts like Jones are wary of Musk's potential Twitter takeover, Whitson, who has experienced targeted attacks, harassment, and censorship threats for decades for speaking out against the Zionist regime's abuses, views this buyout positively. Whitson doesn't agree the bots are a form of censorship, but she does see them as an assault on free speech. She said it's a form of targeted harassment and bullying. It's a targeted attack on people who are speaking freely, including journalists and human rights activists.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about the rules and jurisprudential status of hijab according to Ayatollah Khamenei in this episode and hopefully in the upcoming episodes consecutively. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, salam alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
You're welcome. Well, we are going to, let's say, talk about the jurisprudential rules of hijab or whatever is related to that, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me start this episode with this question. We all know, Sheikh Javid, that there are some larger institutions than, let's say, some familial, for example, circles or small centers such as schools or family, all right? Whenever you are in the society, you take a different role and you are a citizen. And sometimes there are things that are going out of your control. I mean, they are not under your hand.
Yeah.
But as far as the smaller centers are concerned or institutions, such as, for example, schools,
yes.
And you go there either as a student or as a teacher, all right? Or as a worker, simple worker in a school. And then you see things which are not appropriate in your eyes, for example, whenever it comes to clothes, for example.
Yes.
All right? So what are the rules and what are the, let's say, duties that you have toward those individuals who come to the schools with, for example, inappropriate dress?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when, for example, you see that a girl is wearing, let's say, close-fitting dress, or let's say, see-through dress, or let's say, and she is her hijab or her clothing is not appropriate in according to Islamic standards. So here we are. We have to do our duty or fulfill our duty to forbid that individual or that girl from wearing that kind of dress, because that dress is un-Islamic. It causes other people...
Provocative.
It is provocative. It is flashy. It is, eye-catching. And therefore, it is haram. It's necessary to remind that girl of her duty to wear proper clothes. And of course, this issue comes within the category of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar. And I think we discussed this issue in one of the previous episodes. And of course, there are certain stages and certain conditions which must be fulfilled when we enjoin
the good and forbid the evil.
Of course, when enjoining the good, we must we must be aware of what is haram and what is halal. And of course, there are certain stages or steps that must be taken. And the order among the steps also must be observed. For example, as long as the first stage or the first level is effective, it's not permissible to use the next level or the next stage. For example, there are different levels of oral enjoining, You cannot go to the harsh level as long as this gentle speech or gentle a piece of advice works. And when a soft speech is effective, it is not permissible to use offensive or harsh remarks. And so this is these are some general conditions which I mentioned in regard to enjoining good and forbidding the good and forbidding the evil.
Yes.
The same is the case with the scenario you mentioned. For example, if a student comes to the class without proper clothing, then it's the duty of not only the teacher but also the students to tell her to cover her head and neck and also wear loose clothes and clothes that are not revealing, not transparent, not see-through, and it's necessary to forbid her from wearing haram type of clothes.
Okay.
And every individual is under the obligation to prevent obscenity from spreading.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our discussion on hijab. La ilaha
illallah, Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the jurisprudential rules of hijab according to Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, so you said before the break that it is a duty for any individual, in fact, to, participate in the enjoining the good, the act of forbidding the evil, if, for example, a boy or a girl, for example, comes to the school with, without a proper dress, right?
Yes.
But sometimes you see that this is happening, in fact, in a non-Islamic country. So we are talking about lots of Muslims in non-Muslim-dominated areas. What can they do? Can they really, in fact, enjoin the good or forbid, for example, those people or prevent them from, such obscenities?
Well, non-Muslims do not wear the hijab.
Yes.
And it's not even haram to look at their hair and at their body parts, which they usually do not conceal or cover, So it's not our duty to enjoin them to wear proper clothing. But of course, if there are Muslim sisters, Muslim women who do not observe hijab, and the duty of hijab is still there, and you need to forbid them from obscenity, to prevent the obscenity, and of course to enjoin them and to wear proper Islamic dresses.
I see.
And of course, when it comes, like for example, you know, men and women getting, you know, mixed.
Yes, this is my next question. If there are certain places,
yes,
such as educational centers, where you see, for example, such as a university, where you know that there is co-ed classes.
Yes.
All right. So if men and women are mixed in those classes, and you know for sure, because you've been there, for example, you've seen or witnessed that some of the women are, you know, let's say, mingling with others without any proper, for example, dress system or code. So what is your role? Can you register in those classes?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there is no objection, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, to going to educational institutes for acquiring knowledge and teaching, you know. It is absolutely permissible. However, it's incumbent on women and girls to observe hijab. It is equally incumbent on men to avoid looking in haram way and keeping away from mixing with the opposite sex, which normally leads to some kind of temptation and corruption, you know. But as long as you are confident and as long as you control your nafs, your lower, you know, self, and you are certain that you will not fall into any sin, and you will not look at girls without hijab with lustful intention, and you have no such intention, of course, there is no objection to going to such educational institutes or such academic centers. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely permissible, provided that those conditions are fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.